Welcome to Writers Talking TV, brought to you by the Writers Guild of Canada. For most of us writers, the process of bringing a show to air requires our total energies. But what happens when you have a show that's on the air and you're charged with making each year better than the previous? I'm your host, Cal Coons, and our guest tonight is Peter Mohan, one of Canada's most experienced writers and showrunner of CTV's The Listener, which under his direction has continually evolved and increased its audience each year, making it one of the network's top-rated shows. So, what's Peter's secret?
Well, hi everyone. I think we're going to get started here. I'm not Dennis McGrath, and I'm not Jill Golic even. I'm Cal Coons, and I'm filling in for Dennis, who actually snagged a very nice little gig and is out in Vancouver on Continuum. And so they asked me to fill in, and it's a real treat because our guest tonight is, of course, Peter Mohan, who is one of the really great guys to work with. Very experienced and very supportive. And, you know, I've had the pleasure of working for Peter as both a writer and a director, and it's just been a treat. And he brings, immense amount of knowledge. So tonight we're going to talk about The Listener, and I thought one of the things that was interesting is the angle we're kind of take on it is we fight so hard to make a show. To get a show on the air, the fight through the development process, and really gear ourselves towards making a show. And the joke then, of course, is, well, here's the good news. We're going to make a TV show. And here's the bad news. You're going to make a TV show. And so, you got to be ready for not only what you, what you get, but also the fact that, oh, yeah, this thing keeps coming back year after year. And each year you're expected to make it better than the previous year, despite how well it did. Maybe it did poorly. Maybe it did wonderfully. But these things grow and change, and that's what this show is about. Peter has manned the showrunner position on The Listener for the last two seasons, and it has changed and grown, and the numbers have grown with it, and it's doing very, very well. It's evolved, continued to evolve, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight, is the sort of long-term life and what it means to actually, once you've got your show up, keeping it on the air. So, Peter, welcome. Blah, blah.
Thank you.
And I guess we should start by, if you could maybe fill us in on the history of the project, the first few seasons of the show, and your involvement with it.
Okay, well, the show came to be from, was based on a feature film that was written by a writer named Michael Amo, and it was originally, I believe, called The Listeners, and it was a whole world full of people who could read minds, and the hero of this movie was someone who was paranoid in a room that he'd covered with tinfoil and everything and trying to block out the voices. But clearly when they sold it as a TV series, that was too dark a concept and wouldn't support sort of a weekly episodic structure. So they changed it. And the first concept was that he was a paramedic who was intent on helping people and could not resist when one of these distress beacons that came to him from other people's minds, he could not resist acting on them and going out to help people. It was a good good season, the first season. It was a bit of a complicated structure to tell stories in, just because Toby was off doing his thing, the police were off doing their thing, and his partner Oz was kind of doing some Grey's Anatomy in the hospital, and so it was kind of a fractured shape to it, and but it was very successful, and people loved the characters, and that situation morphed in the second season to having Toby meet some people from a high-end Canadian police agency called the IIB, and becoming involved as their informer and a special consultant, where he'd read minds for them, and but still carried on his paramedic duties. And the show really started to find its way more and to become more focused. But when the third season came around, it was clear from as I came on from speaking to all the partners at the networks that they were much more interested in it being a straight up police procedural, and in fact shifting it full on into that was just a great move, because Toby had an emotional involvement suddenly in the cases from the first scene, where he comes to the scene of the crime with the other cops, and he's able to often read things right from there that reestablishes the franchise of the show and establishes his involvement and attitudes for him and for his partners about each individual case. So it became a much more reproducible structure, and it became something that the audiences could tie into very easily and got behind in a big way. So so that's basically where the third season took it. Toby went in-house into the IIB, but it was kind of a sort of a tentative relationship in the third season. And what happened in the fourth season is we made the decision to really have Toby take a much bigger commitment to the IIB, to police training, and to becoming a cop. And there's a lot of things that happen when one makes that decision, and one of them we'll see tonight in the episode we're going to see, where he sees a friend of Michelle's having been shot, a fellow cop, and learning what that's like. And there are a lot of touch points in the season where Toby goes undercover in a very dangerous undercover mission with people who are known to kill their own gang members and so on and so forth, things that he'd never thought of doing before, but each one a step further into a commitment to the job and to becoming a cop. So that's sort of the movement through the seasons and through Toby's journey. And there's a lot of emotional things too. It's funny, as much as there was not a huge appetite for Toby to have a lover or to have relationships, you know, we kind of realized that that's the crack that really keeps people coming back, because it's people want to see that. They want to see who that person loves, who your hero loves, what they care about, and they're great ways to complicate your hero's life. And so in the third season, we introduced a character named Tia, who there was always an issue amongst the networks who felt that Toby can't have a lover, because if he can read her mind, it's kind of rapey and it'd be creepy. And so we realized that really the only woman that Toby could be with under those notes, under that attitude from the Nets, is a woman whose mind he couldn't read. And so that was Tia. And we introduced her in a few episodes in the third season. And if you watch the show, you'll see that it becomes a much bigger runner throughout this season. And their relationship takes some huge twists throughout the season. And it turns Toby's life around quite a bit from episode to episode. But for Toby, that was the main emotional movement in his life throughout this time.
So I mean, those are some very big changes, Peter, clearly, over the course of seasons. To back up, maybe we could take it apart in a little bit, nuts and bolts, and, you know, just start with, you know, part of the exercise was obviously to make a more efficient storytelling machine, easier to write the scripts, frankly. And I was wondering if you could talk about what the challenges are with the listener and what the essential conundrum is around having a psychic as a lead, and how that has been part of what has precipitated these changes.
Yeah, well, you just hit on the biggest problem with the show, is you have a psychic who's trying to solve crimes, and I think one of the biggest things that we did to solve that was to actually codify what exactly his power was and what the limits of the power was. And in the first season, Toby would get these distress beacons that he couldn't control, that would be someone in need or someone in danger or someone's guilt, whatever. But also, because it was a cool thing to do, he was allowed to read someone capriciously. Like if he'd go to a bar to question her about something, he could read that she's thinking he's cute or something. But what we did is tried to make it that to make it something that is organic with him being in a police unit. When Toby's partners now Toby's power is much more that he can read only what's at the surface of the person's mind. So it becomes a collaborative thing of Toby's partners asking questions, and that's at the front of the mind, then Toby can snatch it. So it's much more, it's a collaborative effort between them, and he doesn't have the power to go deep into someone's mind to find guilt that might be there or to find details that they're not willing to offer or aren't thinking about right at that moment. But that was a big evolution in telling the stories, because really, if there is a super deep level of hell, it's probably someplace where people are trying to create mystery stories with a telepath as the as the detective.
But you know what's when you tell it that way, Peter, it seems like readily obvious almost. Yet it wasn't, or it's a very hard place to morph the whole show to. Why do you think that was?
There were many voices at the beginning, and it just needed a consistency of approach, and the codifying what the power was a big part of that. There were many things that were under discussion in the first couple of seasons, and everybody kind of got behind this concept, which as you say makes it a simpler storytelling vehicle, and the power becomes a more homogeneous, a simpler a power to understand and to use practically.
When you change the show like this, was there concerns about, well, how will the audience react to a kind of a different show this year, or how did those changes?
You know what?
I think
there's things that the audience, that the network CTV had done a lot of research, and they knew what the audience, or they had pretty good information about what the audiences liked. And sure, you know, they loved the guy with the big blue eyes. They loved the relationship of Toby and Oz, which
my eyes aren't blue.
No, it wasn't you. It wasn't you. It wasn't me. It was, but
it was.
But the Toby Oz was central to it, and the third thing they were looking for was good layered mystery stories, and so that was the thing that was bonded onto that, and that more a procedural approach to things. So it was pretty easy to see what they loved and what would help the thing move to the next level.
When you say that, then Peter, what does it say? I mean, we as writers, of course, get very concerned about our larger arcs, our continuing storylines, our preconceptions of our mm-hmm. of our own material, and yet, you know, at the end of the first season, there was quite an interesting mythology being set up about other mind readers and his mother and where he came from, and that really vanished. Do you think? And yet, the audience has never floundered for it. It accepted that.
Well,
what does it say?
It's funny. I think there still are people on the net who were hardcore fans from that time who were asking those questions. And Rainbow here, we have a an honored guest of Rainbow, who plays Dev on the show. you'll know that people are probably still asking all that stuff
on Twitter
and everything every day.
Did you learn about his brother and his mom again?
Yeah.
No.
Just
watch me. I'm really good at computers.
There you go. it was all cool stuff, but a lot of it didn't fit with the direction that we're going. Now the thing is that a show like this, it keeps changing, keeps moving. And it's funny because this show was bought from a science fiction story and a science fiction film, and in its DNA, it is a genre show. But it became clear when I came on board that nobody wanted to deal with the genre elements and to use as little of it as we could and as sparingly as we could.
And by no one, you mean the networks?
The networks, yes. Yeah. And so we've kind of done that, but that's not to say we'll always do that, and certainly his background and his gift is so central to the way the show works and what the show is that it may be something to revisit, and without going into details of future thoughts, but it may be something to revisit in future seasons. So keep watching.
So when you, Peter, when you actually approach then the show now, do you approach it first and foremost as a mystery crime procedural, or is it a character study, or how are you actually attacking?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because you get a lot of notes from Nets, and there'll be individual notes on stories and so on and so forth. But the one thing you try to protect is the big shape that you have for the series of where the characters are going and where they're winding up. And then let the individual stories service those beats as they play out along the season, and so as long as they left that intact, I no issues with notes. But we in both the third and fourth season kept to the plan that was set at the beginning, and took Toby through the changes he had to go through, and Oz and
right.
The gang.
And how I know we've seen characters come and go. How did you approach that?
I think the main one that went, I guess, was Charlie, Lisa Marcos's character in the first season, and in the second season, Michelle and Dev were brought in. And but a lot of the other characters remain. The things like the mom and the Colm Feore character in the first season, that was jettisoned at the beginning of the second season, and really they took a hard turn there and never looked back and never really explained it, and we in the third season jettisoned a little more of it, I suppose, but I think most of the characters were changed already. We just jettisoned the really his life in the paramedic bay, and we kept his boss and Oz going there for a while. But in the fourth season, as people will see, Oz has actually taken a job now as the emergency services coordinator in the hospital. So we have one less world to service in the storytelling.
And how would you say has this affected the ability of the room and the writers and yourself to actually just approach telling an episode of The Listener? What has, if you had to sum it up, what has improved?
Well, I think it's certainly easier to tell a story, and stories that an audience can get into very quickly and know what the stakes are and understand the way things are working. But it's much easier to tell the story. You think of the emotional beats you want to hit in the story. You think of a cool crime that will resonate with that, and a great way into the story, and let it flow from there.
So when you're approaching these years, then Peter, how are you doing it? Are you working on your own, and then you gather your team with you, and you begin pitching, breaking it down?
Usually what I've done is created a document which has the shape of that I'm proposing for the season, and present that to the net before they actually greenlight the season. And once that's all in a row and they feel comfortable, they will greenlight the season, and then the team will all come on board and we'll start breaking down the individual episodes and break them together. And one writer will take an episode off and write it, and then we'll bring it back to the room and note it and bring it along to fruition.
Just to get a glimpse into the showrunner's world, I mean, you're in pretty rarefied air for many of us. When you say notes, you know, what are you actually dealing with at that point? Well, these aren't boy, I don't like this character's name or their dress.
I think with the notes I was talking about were not even network notes, which will, you know, come down the line. But I think once someone has written either an outline or a draft of a script and brings it back to the room for notes, a writing room, I guess a lot of you know the concept of a writing room, but basically it's turning, you know, 4 to 7 or 8 people into a big brain that's all focused on making this show and has the same vision, and although with all different, you know, experience sets and creative inclinations, but they're all people you trust, and they're all people who are in sync with each other and all working positively and collaboratively, and we'll look at these and be the first best audience for each other's work and make notes on how to make it better and how to make it bigger and smarter. You know, I think feature writers might take 2-3 years to write a script, but we might have a week to get it on the floor. So you can throw it into this machine, and you've got a bunch of really smart people working together and pumping out a script that's homogenous with all the others and is pretty well developed.
Now, do you think this is unusual, the experience the show's gone through, Peter? I mean, we hear about the success stories far more often than we hear about things that are hard. And I just personally find writing hard, because if it were easy, everyone would, of course, be doing it. And if I were smarter, I suppose it would be easier as well. But it's hard, and Listener has been hard. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt
it's
about
one of the
it.
Hardest. Yeah, it has been. It's got a long and storied past, and I guess in the first two seasons there were 30 some writer producers and 9 showrunners who went through the first two seasons. So it was a hard show.
Right. But you know, in your experience, and you know, looking back and in the situation that you're from, as writers and that are aspiring to get our own shows on the air or not, you know, is this something that's you know, I wouldn't say typical, because it seems extra hard, but are the challenges like of every show? Like you get through year one, and then what happens?
You know what? Every show has a challenge, and you never know where it's coming from. And sometimes you think one is going to be the most complicated thing ever and the most hellish project ever, and that turns out to be just a lovely experience, as this has been. And sometimes you think it's all going to be great, and you've put together a dream team, and it turns out to be, you know, something you wish you hadn't gotten involved in. So it's but you never know where challenges come from. But you always know that each show will have its particular set of challenges, and you just roll. You just have to roll with it. It's. I mean, I think a big part of it is having a vision and having a strong vision of where you want to go, but knowing that it's not going to be a direct line. You're always living on shifting sand. One network might love a storyline, the other one might hate it, and so you may have to jettison the whole thing, or you may have to turn the story 180 degrees to suit one or the other. But it's just you're always on shifting sand, and the more you can understand that and roll with it, the better off you are.
I think it's very true, because certainly my experience is that a show you think is there could be killed, and we had that happen in second season, where just 10 days before we're going to shoot, you know, the network said, you know what, we're not doing that show, bam, gone.
But I think for me, as I say, I think for me what's important is the specifics of an episode. Sometimes you'll let go, as long as they don't take the big vision away from you, the big picture, because if they do that, then you don't know the stories you're telling, and it becomes a dog's breakfast, because one week the character cares about this, the next week he doesn't care about that, and he's doing it for another reason, and it's just, you don't know what you're writing, the audience mm-hmm. doesn't know what they're watching, so you just have to fight as hard as you can to protect that against going away from you.
But I guess, Peter, that's really, to me, a big part of show running, right? Like that, you having,
I think, yeah, the social aspect of it and the political aspect of it, I think, is a strong part of that. I think there was somebody who said, "I always let the networks get my way," but you have to be collaborative and engage people in a way that everybody, they want to be collaborative with you, and I think that means that they know that you're listening to them and that you respect them, so they will be easier to give over to you, and nobody gets entrenched in positions as much, and it becomes a much more collegial and collaborative effort.
Yeah, while maintaining, the big picture. Like, I think that's what I found very interesting, what you're saying, is these elements I want to keep, so we can't do it this way. How will we do it?
Well, I think, too, one way I like to do it is by not trying to push too much at people at once, but to take them along in baby steps. So that's why pitching the shape of a season as a four-page document or something first, and then breaking it out into a more... And once everybody's bought into that, you're not asking them to buy wholesale a whole lot of a season or many, many details. But if they buy the big picture, then... they've already bought into the big picture, so then... once you've broken it down more, they have to kind of buy into that, because it's just, they may have problems with a couple of specifics, but then they've bought into that. And then as you break out the individual episodes, people have signed on bite by bite, rather than having something thrown at them that's as a fait accompli, that they suddenly have to, feel they have to respond to in a big way and turn the ship at that point. Mm-hmm. But I think keeping everybody with you at every step of the way, I think, is a really important aspect of it, of the success of this, and as a successful way to do it.
Well, it's, once you mentioned to me something about judo, you just kind of let the force of your opposition go past
you.
But I think that's a good lesson for writers, is the idea that it's a combination of being very knowing what you want and not losing sight of that, but not entrenching yourself in a place that too rigid.
I think it's interesting we're talking about the political and social aspects of it now, because it is interesting. The more one entrenches, the more people on the other side will often entrench. And I worked with a producer many, many years ago who had been he was one of the cops who broke the French Connection. And he would say, "I want this." And I'd say, "Well, we can't do that because this will be a problem, this will be a problem, this will be a problem." He'd say, "I want it like this." And I'd say, "Well, if we do it the other way, it'll be great because of this and this and this and this." He'd say, "I want it the way I want it." I'd say, "Absolutely. We'll do it that way. It's going to be fabulous." And the thing is, I called it my three strikes rule, because if I did it that way, I had a pretty good chance of winning the next argument, the next argument, the next argument. But I find that often A-type people don't need the specific that they're arguing for, but they need to be right. And if you're not... fighting them, they'll let you have what you need often. So I won a lot more arguments than anybody else with him.
I think we're probably pretty close to actually watching an episode. I forgot to do one thing, which we'll do in a minute, but maybe you could just introduce the episode we're going to see, Peter, and kind of the elements of it that you think, you know, demonstrate, you know, sort of the changes you made and why you think they're working. We can talk more about that on the other side.
Okay. This is an episode called The Blue Line. It's one where an early episode where Toby is brought, as I think I'd set it up a little bit before, where Toby's brought into a case where a friend of Michelle's, a cop, has been killed. And so he's having to deal with her grief and seeing an ugly part of the job and a deeper part of the job than he'd seen before. And it's something that he's kind of gives him a second thought about what he's doing throughout this episode. So that's about it.
So quite different from the earlier episodes. Just a quick poll of you guys out there: how many have seen, you know, sort of episodes of The Listener over the course of its lifetime? Great. So you probably are all seeing that. It's like, wow, it's a different place than it was in years one and two. So Peter, maybe we could get into a bit more the nuts and bolts of Listener and how it works. Typically, so you guys have developed a year. Yeah. You come into the room with some people like James and Brendan and Darren, part of the listener writing staff there. And where's it go from there? How do you guys take the document you've sold the network and phase it into the show that exists?
Well, you know, the big character movements that you've pitched, we'll parse them out and throughout the season and figure out where along the timeline it would be good for certain things to happen, and then work out stories around those. And generally not moving. This is largely an episodic series and not a serialized series, and nobody wanted it to be serialized. And in fact, you know, for network TV, for cable TV, where you've got a very loyal audience who will, you know, binge watch or will be very loyal to it, serialization works great, but the episodics work well for big broadcast networks, which is why the CSIs and Castles and so on and so forth work, where you move character situations a lot more glacially.
And what do you look for from your staff? What do you expect them to come in with? Are you looking for? Do you bring in a group of ideas, or do you expect them to bring in the ideas? How does that work?
Well, generally, I mean, I've been lucky enough to have some continuity with James over these seasons, and so everybody comes in with ideas, and we pitch them all together, and then come up with new things as we sit down. Often, just a story nub that might butt well with the emotional point in the season that we're looking to work on right now. So there's all kinds of ways to skin that cat, you know.
And you guys work first on the season, or do you go through the
absolutely,
stories? How does it
absolutely.
Work
season shape. You have to get the season shape down first, and then let the episodic stories work within that, and they have to kind of, you can't have too many you know, Toby and Jeopardy situation stories together, and so you'll parse out the stories so that they make kind of a pleasing journey as well.
Right, and so are you tent-poling some sort of key moments in the year? Is that
absolutely
how?
There are some, you know, even within the through line of Toby moving further into the experience of being an officer, there's some really hard choices he has to make, and some really dramatic moments that are spaced out throughout the season. And so things like that, the things that are the serialized elements, are the things that we get down first, and then work on individual stories afterwards.
And do you have is there a rough formula to a particular episode? Peter, are you following ABC storylines through the year, through both the season and the year, or how is that working?
Absolutely. Each of the as you'll see in this episode, Superintendent Martell was introduced, and she became the foil for Alvin Klein, their boss, and she has a lot of political machinations that she moves throughout the season, and the balance of power between them shifts in some fun ways throughout the season. And we didn't get into it here, but by this point in the season, with Michelle, her husband Adam, with whom she's been reunited last season, he is actually pressing her to have a child, and just getting back together with him and trusting him again after he had been involved in criminal activities was a big thing for her. But now the next step of actually having a child and committing herself that much more becomes a huge thing in her life and in our the build of her character and her experience throughout the season.
And one of the other things that's introduced in this show, which I think is becoming a reality for all us writers, is the web.
Uh-huh.
And could you talk a bit about the subplot in there with Missy and what her role was and what's actually going on there for the bigger picture?
Yeah, there were actually a couple of things within the Oz and the showing the young reporter through the emergency room. One of them was that that Missy, the young reporter, is actually the star of the web series. And so this was meant to set her up, and then we don't see her again in the series, but she goes off throughout the web series to work with Sandy, solving a big mystery. The other thing that that scene was doing was that the woman doing the hairstyles is actually a very large Twitter personality, and she's got a few hundred thousand Twitter followers, and is somebody that we were looking to, work with her team to get it going, and also Gregory Gorgeous, who's the person who was standing at the desk making the jokes about the girls in Blood and Tartan. Pardon me? He's another YouTube star. Yeah, huge. Hundreds of thousands of followers. So once again, we're trying to work with the web audience and get them engaged in the broadcast show as well. And as we say, of course, Missy touched off the web series, which Cal directed. And
It was fun. The whole interweaving of the two worlds is, are becoming more and more of a reality. It's still hard, I think, because it's hard enough to make a show, and then you have to make a web series on top of it that fits in somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So if knowing that going into next year, is that something you're going to try and interweave even more, or where do you see that going?
Do you know what? I'll be absolutely frank. I still think that the broadcast story and the broadcast product is the thing that brings a million and change viewers, and I think that the web is interesting, but it's so hard with all the partners and all the hoops one has to jump through to do the broadcast show, that it's almost you can't have the tail wagging the dog by having worrying too much about the web at that point. But if the web does respond to what's really going on the show, I think that's great. So if they can work hand in glove, but it has to be one at this point anyway, following the other. At some point that may change, the balance of that may change, but I think for now you have to get the show right, and then those ancillary things can be conceived from that.
Right. So let's go back a little bit more to the nuts and bolts of the actual writing process on Listener? You've got an idea. I assume you guys have a kind of do you have a pitching process where you toss it out and you get it through the hoops together, and once you've agreed on it, what next? Where's it go from there?
Generally, like I say, I take things along in bite-sized units, and so we'll generally pitch it to the Nets as a as a three or four paragraphs, sort of almost like a TV guide review, where you're telling the crime of the week, and you're telling the stakes for each of the major characters and how it affects their lives, and showing where the big mythological units of the or elements of the season play into that story. So really just the just a kind of a bite-sized bullet point story, and we'll generally pitch four or five of those at a time. If you pitch too many, people are inclined to throw out more, but generally pitch four or five at a time, and then take those back and once they're approved, and break them out as a group on a big whiteboard, and somebody will take it off and write it as an outline.
Right. So do you actually do the breaking then as a group, not as an individual? Nobody
as
comes in with 35 beats or something like that.
No, it's something that's this is a really complex show, and it's one that but I think most shows work this way, but especially with this one because it's so complex. It's really useful for everybody to pick apart a story and to throw in on it to make the plots work and to really get the most out of them.
So you break it as a group, and then one writer's assigned the task of turning it into an outline. Then
that's right, and then they'll go off and they'll write the 20-page outline, bring it back. We'll all do notes on it. And hone that a bit, and then send it to the Net, and then the Nets will rip it to pieces, and then we'll start at square one again. After the notes, we'll then say, where do we go from here, just adjust it, and then that writer takes off and writes it.
Right, and sort of what do you what sort of the turnaround that you expect from a writer on an outline?
Generally, about a week to write an outline.
Yeah.
From a broken story.
Right, so it goes through its rewrite process, and then it goes on to draft.
Right.
I assume. What's the size of the scripts that you're delivering these days, Peter?
Well, it's funny because the networks really like these to be cut quickly. We don't leave a lot of air before or after, before dialogue starts or after dialogue ends in a scene. And so we've been pumping out 62, 63 page scripts. A lot of shows might be doing 52, 53 pages.
So that's a big page count for production.
It is, especially in a show that's challenged in some ways, as this is. It's not the biggest budget in town, and it's also we've become a regional show, so we shoot a lot of the season in Hamilton now. Everything that's not on our stage, the IIB or the hospital or Toby's apartment, is actually shot in Hamilton. So that's another stress on the production. So shooting a big page count is tough, as you know, for directors.
Oh yes,
yeah.
How many? Do you have a rule of thumb or a feel about how many beats you're looking for when you're breaking a story, and what your act structure per act, and how that translates into scene size?
Yeah, about 50 scenes, but some are very short, but about 50 scenes. Usually a 2-3 page tease, 15 page act one, shorter act two takes it to around 26-30, and like that, split up another, you know, 12, 14 for an act three kind of thing. And then 4 and 5 are generally one act cut in half, so they're 4 or 5 pages each.
Yeah, and you don't tag it, do you?
No. Four and five are usually, that takes the place of a tag, that last short act.
Right, so 5 kind of pays off the back half of the big
the crisis. Takedown or whatever.
Yeah, and then the denouement plays out.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And what's the time frame again? Are you expecting from your writers to turn a draft?
Oh, 2 weeks for a draft.
2 weeks for a draft. So it's motoring.
Yeah. It's we shoot an episode in 7 working days, and we have a as everybody usually too
6
short
sometimes, Peter.
And 6 sometimes. You did some 6, but we usually have too short a lead time from the time the money becomes available to the time we have to be shooting. For it to be on the air, and so it's everybody has to work fast, and you need a lot banked by the time you hit the floor at the beginning of the season, because of course they can shoot them a lot faster than we can write them. So
right, are you block shooting this show?
We don't block shoot unless absolutely possible. We may block shoot a scene or two, but it's not a show that lends itself to block shooting.
No, it would eat up scripts even faster.
That's it.
Yeah. So, in the process, how heavy is the rewriting once a draft comes in? Is it a lot of revision work and to getting it to the floor?
Sometimes, not as much this season as last. I think a lot of last season was gaining the confidence of the Nets and. There was a lot more hands-on from them last season, but there is always rewriting. Everybody has their specific interests and vision at the Nets, so they will ask for often very specific things. But it hasn't been horrible.
Right, and are your most how big's the writing staff?
The writing staff this year was 4. Plus, we had some interns throughout the year.
Right, and are the writers working simultaneously as your story editors as well, I assume?
Yes. Yeah, we had, I guess we had three outside writers this season, you being one of them, and we'll generally get an outside writer going early on in the process. So that we can have somebody working on something on the outside while we're jamming further ahead on stories.
Right. And the writers themselves is there enough? You know, you hear the wonderful world of actually getting to follow your script onto the floor and go there. How's that worked out? Can you do that with the show, or is it a hybrid of, you know?
Well, it's funny. This show, we've been spending more time in prep and you know, myself in prep and post than being on the floor a lot. We've had another producer who takes it to the floor, but certainly, you know, there's been always a lot of time spent in tone meetings with the directors and just trusting that they're going to make it right. Certainly, this has been a very complicated year in that you can't get to Hamilton to visit the floor as much as you might want to, and it takes a writer away from the room for a whole day just to go down and make a visit. And we really don't have that much bench strength that we can afford people to be off. On the floor a lot.
Right. So so when typically going through the development process.
But certainly the writers carry it through prep, which was all important.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, and you know, like I got to work with Brendan on mine, and there was like, you know, always somebody, you know, a continuity to it. So it was, you know, the next person would come along, and there wasn't that shift over, you know, which is a really problematic
director's point of view.
So when you guys actually went through prep and you had your how much head time did you have on the show to actually write before you actually got into prep?
I think it was about 7 weeks.
Yeah. So at two, how many scripts do you think you could you had in the hopper?
We probably had six in the first draft.
So six scripts as we went to prep. Is that what you guys figure? Yeah.
Something like that.
And then. Oh yeah! Now we gotta start working with these things. Yeah, so Peter, you hit the floor of the six, and at the same time, you're then I assume start selling the back seven episodes to the network and how the arc's gonna go.
Absolutely, yeah. As soon as you have a little bit of free processing power, to work out the next batch, you get them going as quickly as possible.
So they have a general sense of whether you're going.
It's a war that once it starts. You don't rest until, the last day of shooting.
Right, yeah. And how do you personally divide up your time? Like, I mean, are you one of these Alan Ball sorts where, two drafts are written and then you take it away and rewrite it? Or how do you typically work?
I like to let the writers work with the draft all the way through. And I, sometimes we'll just do a small voice pass or something at the end. And but generally... I think that it's better to let the writer carry it through.
Right. And how do you divide, for the aspiring showrunner here, how do you actually divide your time up? It sounds like, between, editing floor, pitching networks, prepping,
casting, yeah, meetings, endless meetings. It's just, you're just going all the time and... writing fits in where it can, usually late at night or early mornings or whatever, and because once you're in there and the prep schedule has you in its grasp, you really don't get a lot of time to sit and concentrate.
And typical week, 70 hours, 80?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
And weekends. And there's no real weekends when the show's on. It's a 7-day job.
Right. So looking after yourself is important.
Yeah, where you can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, it's doing damage control at the end of the season. I think more than looking after yourself properly.
Exactly. So at the end of the day, you've got to be trying to balance a unified view from all these different elements. I just wondered, people have seen, even an actor, if he comes to you, my character used to do this and do that. I'm always intrigued by that side of the showrunner, that this speaks to the big picture that you're trying to keep in your head. How do you do that as the year evolves? Because surely the plan that you laid out at the beginning isn't,
yeah, but you know what? I think that, and those are great moments because you, I think you once again have to have a big picture arc, but if you've got an actor who's really invested and comes to you and says, how about this and blah 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 blah, this that can, work within the. Once again, it's part of staying flexible and staying loose and able to learn and make it bigger, because that can often meld onto what you've been doing and take it to a whole new place that you hadn't seen. Like, you don't want it to be, I think that people who get calcified and who say, no, this is my idea, this is the idea I have, and it can't change, don't get to be any smarter than they are. But actually, if you can take notes from everybody who's trying to help, be it at a network level, from actors, from craft service. If somebody has a great idea, you don't cut it off to yourself. You weigh it and say, hey, maybe I could do something with that, or not that, but how about like this?
Right.
You're always, I think, looking to make it better, and sometimes ideas come from the funniest places.
Well, it's interesting because we certainly, read so much about the, the showrunner who has this unified view of the, or the guy who had 105 episodes of something written and played it all out. And
I think there are also different situations. I mean, I think that this was not a show that I created. This was a show coming on, in a sense, as a hired gun, and coming in after the fact, and coming in with something that was already pretty far down a line. So it was a thing it was a mission to turn a ship a little bit, and to change it a bit. This isn't something that coming in as my life's work, and it has to be exactly like this. And yeah. Not that I think that that's necessarily a way to do it anyway, but so it was. I don't want to say it was just a job, because it's never just a job, but it was. I think that helps in staying flexible, and that you've got to realize there's a lot already in play, and that you're not so ego wrapped up in exactly what's going on at any moment that you can't shift.
Yeah, it affords you some objectivity, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's interesting, Peter, because we're gonna turn things over the floor and get some people some questions and things that they're curious about, I'm sure. But before we do that, this is a good place, I think, for maybe you could just talk a little bit about your path to where you are, how you got into the business, and what your career path has been, and the changes you've seen over the last number of years.
Okay, well, that's a big story. I started out in television. I got out of film school here in town, and there wasn't much of an industry. But I was writing. I like everybody who comes out of film school. I wanted to be a director, and so I started writing feature films because I realized I'd have to have something great I'd written to leverage my way into directing it, and I just realized that I really liked writing better, and sold an option on that, and went on to do rewrites for a company that was the precursor to Alliance. And then when the show Night Heat came on, which was a cop show in the mid-80s, I started on that series, and we did 100 episodes of that over 5 years. And it was a great training ground. It was, as I say, it was with the executive producer was the cop who broke the French Connection. So he had a lot of experience in police stories and a lot of very specific ideas about television. And he was quite a character. But it was a great learning experience. And I went on from there to do all kinds of shows, a lot of genre shows, Mutant X. All kinds of cop shows, lawyer shows, doctor shows, you name it. I mean, it's one of the great
things. Doctor lawyers?
Yeah, doctor lawyers. Yeah, yeah. Doctor lawyer zombies. but I can't, I mean, it's one of the great things about this country still, I think, is that one can go from one genre to another without getting too locked down, whereas in the United States, even your agent won't pitch you for something outside of your wheelhouse because it's taken them so much work to establish you as being a crime writer. I'm not gonna pitch you as a genre writer, but here you can kind of move back and forth between a lot of different genres.
So how many shows do you figure you've worked on now, Peter? Got a ballpark?
Over 500 probably, yeah, 500 hours.
500 hours, that's not bad, eh?
No, it's a lot, yeah. I've got all the scars, I'll take my shirt off later.
So I think at this point, let's open it up and see if we've got any questions you'd like to ask Peter.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. 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 Janet. Cool.
So the question's, what's the state of American Network involvement in The Listener?
It's shows on the ION Network, which is the network that Flashpoint moved to after they lost CBS or NBC or whoever they were with. We also are played on the Fox International Network throughout the world. South America and Europe and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Sorry? Oh, yeah. Oh, do you know what? The first season this show was on NBC, and Toronto was all over it. This is a show that never had an issue with hiding its Canadianism. And that's a cool thing about it, too, that it doesn't have to pretend. But so many shows like Night Heat, when we started that, you know, we had to have money that had a beaver and an eagle on it. Nobody would admit that it was one or the other, and CBS didn't want to admit that it was Canadian, and CTV didn't want to admit it had an American end. So we were always caught in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Well, there's a good one.
Yeah.
How's the internet going to affect the future of television?
That's a good question. I think that, you know, it's all... a lot of it depends on how people figure out how to monetize the net. And a lot being made now, of course, about Netflix, and that seems like a good model for monetizing it, where people have bought a subscription to something because they're discerning viewers, and this subscription service has high-quality material that they want to see. But in terms of the rest of the net, web series and so on and so forth, I still don't think there's a model to monetize it, and certainly advertising isn't doing that yet, not to create high-quality programming. I think we've still got to figure that out a bit.
Sure. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Cal, one of our staff writers wrote the web series, and Cal, who directs our series, directed the web series.
Yeah, so we had same cameras,
slightly smaller crew.
Pared down crew, definitely, and a pared down schedule. We had to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. It was exactly well. Two takes. That's good. Move. You know. Yeah. A different shooting style, which was allowed for us, but as far as the quality goes, I'd say we could go full on, 1080p. It's exact same camera, same resolution, same post as.
Yes. It didn't really have to hold to the reality of the series, and it was quite crazy at times, quite crazy and humorous.
Yeah, it's a sort of a film noir mystery set against intrigue at a very large ping pong tournament. It takes a lot. It's a bit hard to explain.
You have to see it. I suppose it'll make sense.
Yeah, watch each week. It's on after the show. It's a nice release schedule. Somebody at the back, I think, yeah.
That originated from, it was between, actually, it wasn't generated from the writing room. It was between Smoke Bomb, the company, and the writer on our staff who was working with them. I think they went through two or three different iterations of that story, and I think what finally gave it the shape that it had was simply which actors were available to do it, and then they figured it out from there.
Yeah, it has a.
It's tough because this is shot almost at the same time as the series, and everybody's working so hard, and all the actors are almost working every day. So to take them away for those 4 or 5 days, it was very difficult.
Yeah, that's the key. It's and how you shoot around that and find that extra time and turn the crew around, who's exhausted. It's difficult scheduling. Yeah. Anybody else? Yes. Spec scripts or originals, Peter?
Yeah, I always prefer an original to a spec. It's great to know that somebody can mimic the voice of a show, but it's always interesting to see a writer's own voice.
Do you spec still, Peter?
I haven't spec'd for a few years, but strangely enough, I do original specs and have spec'd other shows 4 or 5 years ago even.
Yeah, you've hung out in Canada.
Yeah.
By choice?
Yeah. That's just, I never stopped, so I just stayed.
Well,
so it's been good. It's lovely.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yes, anybody else? Yeah, back in the corner again.
I don't know, 10, 15 probably. Generally right at the beginning of the season when you've got time to do it and you kind of make your decisions as to who you might want to get involved with by then. And usually people coming in through an agent or something just because it's kind of too complicated to have open submissions.
Yeah, it is a tough bubble, though, to pierce, right, Peter? You know, how do you get the agent and how does the, you know, to get it to Peter?
It's a real catch 22, yeah. But do you know what? There's a lot of people who break the barrier every year and move ahead, and it's just getting your material in front of people and sometimes getting people to do a favor and, you know, getting their ear somehow and getting them to do a favor and getting them to read and you know, putting them onto an agent and then the agent moves them along. There's lots of ways in. It's just you have to be tenacious and just keep flowing against that all the time and get through.
Right. Just out of curiosity, what's how many people here are Writers Guild? Okay. And the rest of you are working towards it or working towards a happy career as a writer, I take it? Yeah. Yep, there's a hand at the back. Good, you fessed up. I'm very proud of you.
The happy part's always questionable, but it is a career.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good to know, I think. And certainly the Writers Guild loves that you come out to these things and you know, get a chance to hear you know, somebody like Peter, who's, you know, I can't tell you how important it is to have a steady hand. Somebody once said you're in a knife fight, so no fast moves, right, you know. And so I saw another hand somewhere. Oh, yeah, okay.
Yes. Well, this year, both of our interns came through the Bell diversity program. Sometimes there are different programs where interns will come to a show. Sometimes they'll be through the Film Center. There's the primetime program there, which is very good at advancing new writers. If anybody does want to get into the industry or move ahead in the industry, certainly that's a great program because one's exposed to all the agents in town and all the networks, or rather the writers are exposed to them, and so suddenly everybody knows your face, and it's much easier to get an agent and to get meetings wherever you want to go. So great program. The NSI, I think, has a program as well that's quite good. Totally Television.
Yeah, it's a great program. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Peter, like, you know, for young writers, like, I mean, you're seeing a lot of them. Is there any general kind of things that you think are positives and that they should, you know, really employ in breaking in, like any lessons that can be learned? And I'm thinking not so much about just, hey, showing up at a party and glad-handing, but I mean about their scripts, like, you know, like, is there a general sort of sense of those original scripts, what you're looking for? What is that? What is that thing that turns Peter Mohan's
head? I think somebody should probably do a few specs so that you have something that's close to the voice of the show you're pitching for. A show like The Listener, because there's some funny elements and some character things, and you know, the wheel of suspects in the mystery, something like a Castle or a Mentalist would be a good spec, say, or an original spec that might have some of those elements. But to do, you know, a Rookie Blue or something, it might be something like a Grey's Anatomy or something along those lines. You know,
anything you'd avoid?
I don't think so. Nothing specific.
Right. Okay. And so you guys.
But if I could just add to that, I mean, I think it's important to have a few in your arsenal so that you can always have something that might interest the different shows in town or the different people you might want to deal with.
Yes, over here, please. So there's a big question, Peter. What's Canadian television doing right, and what does Canadian television need to work on?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's. I mean, I think there's some great shows that are done here, and shows that are doing well in the States. Certainly, The Rookie Blues and Flashpoint did well for a number of years in the big audience down there. I think that for the most part, like shows like this are doing a million and change viewers a week. We beat Castle and so on and so forth. Some of the other big shows, we're winning the night on nights where there are hockey games, the playoff hockey games. So I guess. Canadian TV is doing its job in that it's entertaining Canadians enough that they're watching it. I think that we have limited resources for these shows, and they are not as ritzy as some of the U.S. shows. But I guess there's a lot being done right. I mean, I think they get better all the time. People are learning more and more. We don't have as many of the shows that are really, I suppose, as idiosyncratic as some of the shows in the States, like the big cable shows. Except maybe Orphan Black, which is really a show that's like a big U.S. cable show that is really one person's vision taken cleanly and clearly. To the end, here, because we to do a series like The Listener, or Rookie Blue, or whatever, you usually can't do it just on one network's licensing fee. So you've got to be involved with notes from foreign distributors and from a U.S. network, if you're lucky, and so on and so forth. So there are usually shows that have. A lot more cooks in the kitchen, and have to have a much broader base that they're working rather than, being something that's a more specific story and a more narrow cast.
I think
there's a lot of good stuff being done now, though.
Yeah, has the aesthetic though of the American cable show really affected? You and the sort of shows you're making and positively and negatively
not really, because it's almost a different kind of business. Like the cable channels in the States are as I say, it's like what we might consider a more discerning audience who are paying for the privilege to get a True Blood or something which may have more challenging themes or more serialized stories, but being as this is a broadcast a show, and for a very really planned to be for the broadest audience, it's a different it's like a different animal. So it's like CSI in the States or NCIS or whatever, they'll get 23, 24 million viewers, but the ones that will get the critical attention. would be the ones that, you know, might get $700,000 on FX or one of the cable nets.
Right.
But it's a just a different business. It's an ad-supported as opposed to a network.
Right. Okay. Any more questions? Yes, at the back there.
Well, it was
just for our at-home audience. I'll repeat that because the question was that you have an overall deal with Shaftesbury, which is a very unusual deal in the country. What's been the result of that development-wise? What are you working on? I think that is that sort of in general sum up your question. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Basically, I think. One part of it was to hold me in case we get a season five. But what we're doing is we're developing some of my things and developing some of their things outside of that. And I'm helping them with some of their digital projects. And it's just sort of being a jack of all trades around the company in some ways. But hopefully... some of the things that I'm pushing will come to fruition too.
And anyone else? Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, this, for example, this season, it was the first thing I knew where I wanted to end it. And so it's, I think that's, you know, there was a joke on one of the late night shows that the host had said in his monologue that Lost just got renewed for season six, and in related news, the writers all killed themselves. You know, because I mean, it's an exciting way to tell stories. I think where they kind of make it up as they go along, but I think it's great if you can know where you're going with the season, and lay out seeds of where it's going throughout, and then pay it all off at the end. And certainly for a show like this, I think it works great.
Do you do the same with the episodes, Pete? Do you personally write with the ending in mind and then work backwards, or how do you work an episode?
Yeah, I think the ending is I mean, certainly the emotional ending is somewhere you want to know, something you want to know very early in the process of breaking a story, and then once again, all of the actions throughout it are helping to pay that off.
Great. Anyone else? Yes? So of all the shows you've worked on, what's the favorite?
No. Of all the duties of a showrunner.
Oh.
What are my favorite?
Sorry, can I have a hearing aid?
Yeah. I love writing. I got to say Post is great fun because all the tension's gone. All the stress is off you because there's nothing more you can shoot. There's... nothing going to screw up on set. All of the footage is right in front of you, and it's your chance to remake the show again. You know, scenes you thought didn't work, you can recut them, add music. You know, yeah, you can do a lot at that point, and it's really your last chance to tell the story you wanted to tell.
Yeah, last rewrite.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Peter, about what season five is going to go, what your thoughts are. Can you he's really worried, actually. And you.
I'm alive, right?
No. What's
just a few words? Short circuit computer. grape drank on the floor. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, you know, part of your job, unfortunately, is okay. I've increased the the number's 30%. So this year we're going to go 30 again, right? You know, and well, we're going to do it for less.
Yeah. Well, I think certainly they'd be happy if we carried on as we're carrying on. But I think that if you'd have to really see to the end of the series for it to make sense what the possibilities of the next season are, because it ends at a place with some big things that happen and some dynamics set in play that could launch some interesting possibilities for the next season.
Right, that's cagey.
Well, yeah, I can't tell anymore.
I guess the thing is, are you one of these guys that writes to place?
This was certainly planned to be something that if it ended, it would be a satisfying ending, but if it goes on, there's some hella cool stuff that can spin out over the next season. So I think that's a tricky thing in and of itself to do to service both of those things. But I think we did it.
Right. Well, that's great. Anybody else? Yes.
Well, it's funny. I was one of the 30 people that had gone through that shop in the first season for a short while, between other things. And I'd always thought it was a show that could, that had a lot of possibilities. And I knew it would be complicated, but I always figured that I might have an insight as to how to get through it.
Did you see it as a challenge, Peter, or was it? Or
absolutely, I saw it as a challenge.
Yeah, I was there, of course, in year two, and your chair was someone else. Two of us shoved into your chair, actually. No,
yeah.
But the thing I found that was hard about it was at that stage was how you had a guy who could theoretically just answer the whole mystery in one fell swoop, and so it felt like sort of like if you have Superman as your hero, you continually have to put kryptonite in his
way. That's it. And that was codifying what the powers were was the big trick, I think, because by making as much as possible the what he read from someone, like a message from the Oracle of Delphi or something, almost more puzzling than it was informative. You can keep the mystery going, but you can push the story along and make them feel like they've learned something, and then that will pay off. Once again, it's sort of that marriage of the his reads and the good police work. You know, something he reads, Dev will make sense of by finding out who that person might be, and so everything sort of works together as a whole.
Because you've scaled back his powers, in effect, really, from the guy who could just step out the door and listen to the entire city and hone in on what he wanted to hear.
Absolutely.
To someone who's, you know, got a manageable size of.
Absolutely, and that's the thing, because you know, and there are scenes in the third season where Klein is saying, "Well, hold on, I've got a telepath. I should be able to just, close this case in 10 minutes." But you got a ton of stuff wrong, and that's the thing, and that's what Toby has to tell him. As we were rebooting Toby's power with the audience, Michelle says that's not the way it works. He only sees some things some of the time, and it's not always what we think it is right off the top. So that helped to reboot the way that worked, and it helps us keep the mystery going longer. Of course,
is there a lesson to be learned, I suppose, for us, you know, if we're looking at our pilots or our scripts we're developing, about just how about making this a workable story engine? The lesson I seem to feel is it's you have to be very careful not to overcomplicate the nature of the mystery, and so that you're, you know, have an active hero. Is there a general lesson to be learned from from where you're going, or what your
I think
rule
that,
of
I think
thumb
that,
is?
I think that I don't. I mean, I think that yeah, keep it should be something that certainly in the first pilot episode, people can look at it and say, "Oh yeah, he's a guy that solves crimes." You know, because he can read minds, or he can see through walls, or something or other. Simple to digest as a concept, and has been expressed well, so that they say, okay, here's the problems of how that's going to work for every week. You have to sort of, it's almost like the pilot is you're telling them what you're going to tell them, and then the series is telling them. So it's really it's setting up all the dynamics and setting up. Oh, you know, they just met, but I know he likes her and she likes him, and there's going to be a big thing that happens, and so you're setting up enough things and making people understand that those things aren't going to go to that direction easily. There's going to be a lot of complications still, but it's really giving people a taste of what they're going to get if they sign on to stick with your show. So. Right.
And how important was it for you, Peter, for replication? Like, I mean, so you weren't reinventing things to try and, you know, you have this illusion that every episode is different, but it's really important that every episode is quite the same, or you'll never, you know, be able to find that central conceit or budget it, really.
I think the trick is just finding a different, something different and something unexpected as you go on further with the show, and not having the same story every time, but finding a way to twist it or turn it, and something which is hopefully based in one of our characters, the way they drive it. Do they believe in something too much? Are they do they have too much of a taste for revenge because of something that happened? I mean, I think you twist up a simple police case with their emotional state and throw in some surprises and twists along the way. Yeah. Always.
So yeah, yes. Another question.
No, we kept.
This is a question about directors and did they stay constant through the series, and how do you find your directors?
We kept a lot of the same directors, people that we didn't work with later were generally off doing other business, and we've always had great directors on the show. Kari Skoglund, and who went off to do the Borges and so on and so forth, for example. A lot of people we haven't, have moved on from us, but we've been able to keep a lot of the great ones, like Cal, and we had Farhad Mann for a few, and we found some great new directors, Brad Walsh, and we worked with
Paul Fox,
Rob Lieberman, Paul Fox, great, and Peter Stebbings, who plays Klein on the show, actually has directed some of our best episodes of the whole series, which has been great for us.
Yeah. The
We usually find them through through Craigslist, through agents, and we contact the agents through Craigslist. Do you know what we generally? I think the trick is with a series. Is it's nice if a director is stylish, but generally they have to adhere to the style of the show, the visual style of the show. And I think, you know, there's a lot they'll bring, but a lot of it is the look is set by the DP and so on and so forth. And it's a style. They all have to look the same and feel the same. And a lot of the conventions, like, Toby's visions and so on and so forth, have to be similar each time, so that the audience feels comfortable with that and they understand it. It's the language of the show.
Any more questions? Okay. Well, Peter, it's been great really getting an insight into the listener and how it's grown and changed over the years. Any final thoughts, any words of advice to pass on?
Oh, gee, I am not really. Watch the listener.
There you go. Yeah.
We got some great stuff coming this season.
Oh, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you, and you can email us at writerstalkingtv@gmail.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please log on to iTunes and leave us positive feedback to help increase the profile of the show. This podcast is sponsored by the Writers Guild of Canada. The show's technical producer is Philip Vukovic. I'm Cal Coons. Thanks for listening.